book of Revelation. We've been spending several weeks on this chapter because it is such a significant chapter. It gives us a portrait of the two principal sources of opposition to those who will be believers during the time of the tribulation. The two principal sources of opposition, of course, will be a false church or an apostate church, which will be led by the false prophet, that will focus attention of people upon worship of Satan and of the Antichrist. And we also know that the other major focus and the other major opposition comes from the political arm, if you will, the empire of the Antichrist, as full control is extended across the entire world by the evil one. And we know that there will be an internecine strife in the middle of that seven-year period as the political arm, if you will, of the Antichrist turns against the front organization, the false church, in the middle of this time period. And that will change the ground rules as all the wraps come off and as Satan no longer hides behind the facade of a supposed religion, but instead says, no more playing games. I will be the focus of worship. My image will be placed in the temple. There will be worship conducted, and it will be directed toward me, or else. And that or else, of course, will be horrific for those who are found unwilling to worship the image of the beast and who would be unwilling to take the mark of the beast. We know that believers will have the discernment to see the false nature of that message and of that move and will resist. And we know that the resistance to the Antichrist, when it's discovered, will result in persecution and in many or most instances will result in martyrdom during this time period, the second half of the seven-year period called the Great Tribulation. We've looked already at the first part of chapter 17 of the book of Revelation at this apostate church or this false religion. And while I believe it's going to be headquartered along with the political arm of the Antichrist, headquartered in Rome based on evidence in this particular chapter, it will not be, in my mind at least, absolutely identical with the Roman Catholic Church as we have come to know it. It may inherit the accoutrements, it may inherit some of the outward manifestations and all of that, but it will all be facade because this new false religion will not be specifically or uniquely, it won't even pretend to be Christian. It will be anti-Christian. And it will be eclectic in the sense that all of the world religions will somehow be gathered underneath this tent in a neutral, quote-unquote, neutral kind of religion. So that will be the nature of this false and worldwide church, the apostate church, led by the Antichrist as the object of worship, and, of course, whose, quote, worship, unquote, will involve not only idolatry but immorality, and that will be fostered by the high priest of the beast, namely the false prophet. So that's what we have already seen with regard to that false religion that will occur and obtain during the time period called the tribulation, especially the first half of the tribulation. Last time we talked about in verse 7 the angel beginning to explain the symbolism, the meaning of the imagery that the Apostle John is being allowed to see here, the imagery of the woman who rides of the beast, and now today we're going to see the explanation of the beast himself here in this particular chapter. And so we read read in verse 7, and I'll reiterate, but the angel said to me, why did you marvel? Because of all of the horrific nature of what will be going on and all of the persecution that will be going on during the time of the tribulation, the apostle John was dumbfounded and just utterly shocked by what he saw. And so he says at the end of verse 6, I marveled with great amazement. The angel says, why do you marvel? And this is all within God's control. This is all, if you will, under his divine and sovereign plan. I think this is one of the things that we as believers need to understand about our lives and about our world. That there is no such thing as an accident with God. That there is no such thing as a world out of control with God. That God is on the throne. That God is sovereign in the sense that he controls the affairs of men and of nations. That we read elsewhere in Scripture that the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. that all events are orchestrated by God intentionally to bring about His purposes and His will. And we're going to see this explicitly stated even later on in this very same chapter. He causes all things to work together for good and for His glory, especially as we will perceive it as believers to those who love Him and to those who are the called according to His purpose. Well, enough about the mystery of the woman. What about the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns? Now, we know that symbolism, and this particular symbolism is not unique, of course, to the book of Revelation. We can see something quite similar in some of the prophetic books of the Old Testament, in particular Ezekiel and Daniel. But the imagery here of a grotesque, monstrous beast with the kind of oddity of appearance, seven heads, ten horns, that would be, shall we say, cringing or cause us to kind of wince as we think about the grotesque nature of this beast and of the image being portrayed here for John. We recognize that the whole purpose of apocalyptic literature, this is prophetic, that's the main thrust of the book of Revelation, it is forecasting the future, but it is also apocalyptic in the sense that there are truths being revealed, there are mysteries that are being opened up. And here in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, alone, out of the entire book, we are given a specific explanation of the imagery by the Lord Himself. And so that is what makes this chapter, among other reasons, quite unique. He says, I, verse 7, will tell you the mystery. Going on to verse 8. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. This is the brief biography of the Antichrist. It is a thumbnail sketch. It is a one-liner that you find in the obit section here in the book of Revelation, as we find out what's going to be happening to this one called the Antichrist. It is so brief and so compact in its statement that we realize that from God's perspective, the importance of this being in terms of eternity is nothing more than a footnote and has no great long-term significance as far as God is concerned, even though He thinks He's great shakes, and it's even though He's going to be in control in an unnominal sense, at least, of all the nations of the world during these very end times. Nevertheless, from God's point of view, He's history. He's done. He's going to perdition. And as someone has said, in fact, Pastor Graham is one who has said on more than one occasion that if Satan wants to worry us and cause us to be concerned and guilty about our past, we should constantly remind him about his future. And so that future is portrayed for us rather graphically and clearly and succinctly here at the beginning of verse 8. The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. How's that for an obit? The beast that you saw was and is not. What does that mean? What is that referring to? Go back with me to the 13th. We'll come right back. The 13th chapter of the book of Revelation, where we find out the meaning of that phrase, was and is not. When the Antichrist is introduced as the beast from the sea at the very first half of chapter 13 of the book of Revelation, the picture that is given is of one who is initially in charge and in control of his own kingdom, but then a certain, shall we say, unexpected event occurs, and that event could perhaps be portrayed or characterized as the assassination or the apparent assassination of the Antichrist. There will be a mortal wound sustained by the Antichrist that will cause the whole world to think that this pretentiousness of the Antichrist is totally unwarranted, because this one is obviously very vulnerable if he can be dispatched with in this way. So there will be an initial euphoria on the part of some and surprise on the part of others at the fact that this one who is so powerful should be gotten to and be done in the way that is described here in the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation. And so what do we read here in the 13th chapter? Well, first of all, in verse 1, we see a description very, very similar to the one that we have just read here in the 17th chapter when we finished reading a moment ago, which in verse 7, the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns, that same description is given to us in the first verse of chapter 13 of Revelation. Then I stood on the sand of the sea. John says, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. I don't know if you remember any of those old sci-fi movies from the 50s, The Monster from the Sea, you know, rising out of the sea. Well, that kind of grotesque monster, you know, with water falling off the scales, if you can imagine that kind of imagery, is suddenly looming in front of us here in verse 1 of chapter 13. A beast rising up out of the sea, having, grotesque figure, 7 heads and 10 horns. And on his 10 horns, did I say he was 10 horns? No, I'm 10 horns. And on his horns, 10 crowns. And on his heads, a blasphemous name. Now, then there's a description similar to what we read of in the book of Daniel, found in verse 2, concerning succession of empires. But then when we come to verse 3 of chapter 13, we read the following. And I saw one of his heads. Now, if the 7 heads, as I'm going to suggest, represent the successive 7 world empires, and if the empire of the Antichrist is the 7th and final world empire, whose reign is momentarily interrupted by this assassination attempt, and then when the Antichrist, as we shall see, is resuscitated and once again reestablishes himself with even greater strength than ever before, and is the 8th, who is also the same as the 7th, because it is still the Antichrist, then we can understand some of what we're reading here in that light. Verse 3, and I saw one of his heads, this would be the empire of the Antichrist and the person of the Antichrist. Verse 3, the 7th of the empires, and I saw one of his heads, one of the 7th, as if it had been mortally wounded. And his deadly wound was healed. Now, the image of the Antichrist being wounded kind of harkens back in my mind the image of Julius Caesar being done in by the perfidious senators who he thought were his friends and surrounded him and did him in with their daggers. And if you read the history of the early emperors, it seemed that with very few exceptions, they all came to a sudden and kind of tragic end, usually a violent end. And so that's what we're looking at here is the emperor. Julius Antichrist, is done in, apparently with an assassination attempt. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded. Now, and then it says, and his deadly wound was healed. Now that does not mean it happens instantly, because we also are reading here in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation that he goes down into the abyss or into the bottomless pit. And understand that the place called Hades, as we read of it in the New Testament, is not unlike what some of the pagans understand about the underworld. That is to say, Hades is the same as the netherworld, at least to the pagans it was. And from the point of view of the Bible, Hades represents the waiting place of those who are lost. The waiting place of those who are outside of God, outside of Christ. The Lord himself gave us a picture of Hades when he told the story of the rich man and Lazarus. And he talked about the rich man's experience in a place of torment, unremitting pain and suffering. Now, Hades is not yet hell. Understand, though they're used sometimes in a popular sense, especially in literature and so on, as interchangeable with hell, Hades is not hell. It is the prep place. It is the holding tank for those who are outside of God and who are outside of Christ. And we read, and we will read at the end of the book of Revelation, that death and Hades will themselves be cast into the lake of fire. There will be no more need for a waiting place when the final purposes of God are accomplished and the judgment has occurred, and then the final, if you will, carrying out of the judgment occurs as those who are outside of God are then put in that same place as Satan will be, put in the same place as the Antichrist and the false prophet will be. All those whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, that is, all of the lost, will be one day consigned to that place called hell, the lake of fire, as it is described here in the book of Revelation. But Hades is the waiting place. There is suffering there. It is also, if you will, the hangout of Satan and the demons. It is a place where the demons themselves congregate. Because we had read earlier, you remember in the book of Revelation, that the time would come when, like locusts, they will ascend out of the abyss. They will come out in great numbers. We also know that later on, as we're going to read, at the very beginning of that 1,000-year reign, the millennial reign of Christ upon the earth, that Satan will be put back in the tank with a lock and key in the bottomless pit in the abyss. It will be a holding place that will hold this criminal. It kind of reminds me of what happened after World War II, when there was, I think there were several criminals that were held in a prison in Berlin called Spandau. And I think it came down to one final Nazi criminal. I'm not sure if it was Rudolf Hess or who it was, but there was one that was left. And they kept the whole prison running for one prisoner. If you will, the whole of the abyss will be kept in business for that 1,000-year period to hold one major and the most infamous of all prisoners, namely Satan himself. So, where do the lost go before the final judgment and before hell is inaugurated? They go to a place called the bottomless pit, or Hades, a waiting place described by the Lord Jesus as the abode of the rich man. So that after the assassination of the Antichrist, he goes to that same place, and then he comes back from that place after he is allowed to be resuscitated. Now we know, if you remember the Old Testament, that there were other attempts to bring up people from the dead. And for those of you who are familiar with occultic practices, you know that there is an attempt to communicate with the dead on the part of people who believe in Satanism and in the Spiritism. In fact, there is one television series that's gone on for this last year called Medium, which is a portrayal of communicating with the dead, something specifically and explicitly forbidden in the Bible. And God asks this poignant, pregnant question. He said, why should a people consult with the dead when they can consult with their living Lord as far as receiving information and help and all of the rest is concerned? So any communication with the dead is going to be an example of Satan worship or a case of demon worship. And in fact, if you go to a seance, it's an attempt to communicate with the dead. And you remember that when King Saul was around, after the Holy Spirit had been removed from Saul, that he became kind of lonely. He used to get help, used to get information from the prophets as to what God's will and God's purpose was. Well, Samuel was no longer around, and he kind of leaned on Samuel. Samuel had a soft spot for Saul, even though Saul didn't deserve it. And so Saul is about to fight a major battle, and he doesn't know what the outcome will be because he no longer has access to God, because they're not on speaking terms, their fellowship has been broken. And so he says, I know what I'll do. I'll go to the witch of Endor, and we'll summon up the spirit of Samuel from the lower world, from the nether world, from the place that in the ancient world was not divided up the way we, because we have the Bible and more illumination, into different kinds of locations. That is to say, paradise being the location for those who are believers in anticipation of Christ's coming, in anticipation of that final carrying of captivity captive, that is the paradise where Abraham's bosom is and where the beggar was and where Jesus said the thief on the cross would be immediately following his death. Today Jesus said, you shall be with me in paradise. There is that part of the nether world, that holding place, if you will, for believers on the one hand, and then there is Hades, the holding place for the unbelievers that is being spoken of here when it talks about the bottomless pit or Apollyon or Abaddon, the various names that are given for this place for those who are under, if you will, charge that they will one day be finally condemned to hell, but which are currently being held, if you will, in cell block B. His deadly wound was healed. Well, you remember the story of the witch in Endor and how the witch, not knowing all these differences that we just talked about, thinking she has power to summon up the shades of the dead, the ghosts of the dead. And by the way, all appearance of ghosts, I don't know if those of you who read about in haunted houses in England and New England and other parts of the world, we are tempted to believe in these things, but I want you to know that all such appearances are really, if you will, misleading appearances by demons. They can take on any facade. They can take on any appearance whatsoever. And so the appearances of so-called ghosts are nothing other than the appearances of spirits that are fallen spirits, that are demonic, fallen angels. So having said that, there are no ghosts in that sense. There are departed spirits, but they don't go roaming about. They are in a place. And so the witch of Endor was to summon up the spirit of Samuel. And so she was about to do her incantations in order to produce this result. And before she had a chance to do her incantations, wow! All of a sudden Samuel appears. Surprise! I didn't do that. Where did he come from? So God surprises Saul and the witch by having Samuel appeared without her ministrations, thank you, and making it clear to Saul that he's not going to have a positive result from this battle. All of this is to say that this is the place from which this bad place, not the place where Samuel was, will be the place from which the assassinated Antichrist will return. And we read again about the fact that the wound was healed down in verse 12. When we read about the other beast, namely the false prophet, the high priest of the beast, who once the resuscitation of the Antichrist leads people to say, look at this miracle. It is an imitation of the resurrection of Jesus, an attempt to kind of mirror the resurrection of Jesus by the resuscitation of the Antichrist. Clearly, anyone who is raised from the dead is deserving of worship, so then it becomes a basis for engendering worship worldwide of the Antichrist, this very resuscitation. And what does the false prophet do with regard to this event of the resuscitation of the Antichrist? While we read in verse 12 of chapter 13 of Revelation, he, the false prophet, exercises all the authority of the first beast, that is the Antichrist, in his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, to worship the Antichrist, the one whose deadly wound was healed. The one whose deadly wound was healed. And so here we have a supposedly faithful experience on the part of the Antichrist. Perhaps we can go further today and say probably it was fatal, because he could hardly have gone to that place called Hades or the bottomless pit unless it were fatal. That would have been a place that he would have gone to if it were fatal. But his staying time there was temporary. And he's brought back to life as in order to wow the lost world. Going back now to the 17th chapter of Revelation. The beast that you saw was, that is, comes on the scene, starts his empire, and is not, that is assassinated. It supposedly dies, we think actually dies, because he goes to the bottomless pit. And then he's resuscitated and will ascend out of the bottomless pit. And after he does his thing for the 3.5-year period, the second half of the tribulation, called the Great Tribulation, after the final battle of Armageddon, after the Lord returns, and he is defeated, then the false prophet and the Antichrist will be consigned to hell itself, which is a lake of fire. It's interesting to me that the Antichrist and the false prophet go to hell before the devil does. It is perhaps, if you will, the down payment on hell. When they go to perdition, that is when the Antichrist is consigned to the lake of fire, when the false prophet is consigned to the lake of fire after their defeat by the Lord and his forces upon his return. The fact that they're consigned immediately to hell is a way of saying to the world, especially now, this is at the very beginning now of that thousand-year reign of the Lord on the earth called the millennium, a way of saying to the world, this is what you can expect, and what you, Satan, can expect at the end of the thousand-year period. Gives Satan a lot to think about as he is under lock and key, doesn't it? That not there in the waiting tank where he is for 1,000 years, but in the lake of fire are his protégés, the Antichrist and the false prophet. A lot to think about. A lot to stew over. A lot of plans to make. A lot of revenge to plan. And we know that when he comes out after 1,000 years, he goes after it. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. And of course, we saw last time that the ones who will be persuaded by the marvelous experience of seeing the resuscitated Antichrist, marvelous in the sense of wow, those people who will be so impressed will be the lost. Believers will see through it. The Holy Spirit will give that insight, but unbelievers of the earth will be taken in. Those who dwell who are lost on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. And from God's perspective, he knows those who are his from the foundation of the world. Those are those who are written in the book of life. And he knows those who are not his from the foundation of the world. That is, those who are lost. And notice, it does not say past tense, was one of the interesting things about this particular verse when you start to get real close to the language. It says whose names, the lost, that is, are not written in the book of life. Notice it doesn't say who were not written. At least not in the translation of the text that I'm looking at the moment. Whose names are not written. Remember what we said about God in a previous class, that he exists in an eternal present. That all the events of history that transpire, what we call past, present, and future, are all present to him. That the lost that we say someday will be cast into the lake of fire or will suffer hell for eternity, that they are already consigned in his mind and in his understanding because it's all present to him. They are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life from the foundation of the world. He has that eternal perspective. When they see the beast that was and is not, and after resuscitation, and yet now once again is. Here is the mind which has wisdom. That's a phrase, by the way, which is used not only here but elsewhere in this book and similar phrases in other books of the Bible. It's a way of saying, now, here's the story. Here's the insight. Here's what this represents. That the beast that you're looking at, the one who is and who was and now is once again, this is the Antichrist. Understand, that's wisdom. That is to say, that's what you're supposed to understand about that image. What about the details of the image, which the angel promises to explain to the Apostle John? The details of the image are of a beast that has seven heads and then ten as well. Ten horns, who are also ten horn kings, but we won't get into that. Not yet. Verse 9, the seven heads are seven mountains. Now verse 10 says, there are also seven kings. Seven mountains, seven kings. Seven mountains, seven kings. These are two, this is a dual interpretation of the image of the seven heads. This is the only place where there is such a dual interpretation. That is, where there are two meanings. There is one meaning and there is legitimately also another meaning. Both of them represented by the seven heads. So the angel gives that dual interpretation in verses 9 and verse 10 to John. First of the interpretations of the seven heads are that the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Babylon the Great, which is the name of the woman, as we saw earlier in the text in verse 5, is really to be identified with Rome. It is that empire which is a city, or that empire that is controlled by a city that is worldwide. And because of the listing of this, if you will, topographical feature. Now, there are some commentators who would hold that the seven hills are not to be taken as a geographic or topographical features, seven hills literally, but that they stand for seven empires. In one sense, the meaning of the seven heads does stand for seven world empires. In this particular interpretation, that comes up in verse 10, in this particular interpretation, it does stand for the feature, the topographical feature of the city itself. Now, as far as I remember, Babylon on the Euphrates is where Iraq is and where they're fighting today, is a very flat place. There are not seven hills or seven mountains of this particular sort to be found there in southern Iraq, as there are in Rome. And as I looked up the Roman literature on the subject, I found out that before Christ, the phrase the seven mountain city was used to describe Rome before Christ. And it was written by such people as Varro, V-A-R-R-O, and someone else whose name may be a little more familiar to you, a Roman poet by the name of Virgil, who I had to labor through and translate when I was doing my Latin. Even today, in my sleep, I can quote some of the Latin of Virgil. But in Virgil's Aeneid, which is kind of the story of the founding of Rome and all of this, he describes Rome as the seven mountain city. The seven mountain city. And so to describe it, this city, to those who are being persecuted in the first century as a city sitting on seven hills could not be missed, because this was the common descriptor. This was the common way of identifying Rome as the seven mountain or the seven-hilled city. The Latin word colus means hill, mons, montes means mountain, and they are used in the Latin literature interchangeably. seven hills, seven mountains. The seven heads are seven mountains which the woman sits. What are the seven mountains or seven hills called? You don't have to take notes, but just so you know that I actually read it. The Capitoline, the Aventine, the Cilian, the Esquiline, the Quirinal, the Viminal, and the Palatine. And in the Aeneid 6.783, Virgil refers to this seven-hilled city. The apostate church, the one that is called the woman, will have its headquarters in Rome. Though, as I've repeated several times, it is not necessarily to be identified with the Roman Catholic Church. Now, Dave Hunt makes the case that perhaps it will even be in Vatican City, which is a part of Rome, where this headquarters will be. They'll simply take over the property with all the jewelry and all of the affectations and so on. They just take over the property and run their false church out of this already established kind of headquarters. What about the other interpretation? If it's Rome, where the apostate church and where the political empire of the Antichrist will be headquartered during the time of the tribulation, what about the secondary interpretation of the seven heads? That's coming up here in verse 10. There are two meanings of the image. Here's the second meaning found in verse 10. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is. And the other has not yet come. And when he comes, you might want to add, when he comes back, he must continue a short time. Now, what are the seven kings? For those who take what in the interpretation of the book of Revelation is called a preterist view, and preterist is Latin for past, the preterist view simply says that really all of this imagery and all of this prophecy has only to do with the, if you will, the comeuppance of the original Roman Empire. And that the kings involved are just a series of emperors. And that the sixth emperor, which now is usually identified as Nero. But the problem is to get it to fit exactly, you have to kind of leave out a few emperors. There were about three there, what are called interregnum, emperors whose reigns were very, very short. And they say, well, they don't count, so we'll just leave them out and start counting. One, two, three, four, five, six. And so we have a little bit of, shall we say, manipulation of the data in order to come up neatly with the six or the seven. So for those who take the preterist view and says it's all about, and say it's all about Rome, they say that it has to be identified with seven successive Roman emperors. But then they say, yes, but John was writing during the time of Domitian and perhaps even earlier during the time of Vespasian. And so clearly there had to be some other links left out. So one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. It gets to be a little tricky when you start counting in that way and arbitrarily leave out emperors along the way. So much for the insignificant emperors. Five have fallen. Five have fallen. Now, those of you who read history know that there's a great epic work concerning Rome, which is called The Rise and what? Fall of the Roman Empire by a man named Gibbon. For those of you who are interested in more recent history, remember in 73 or 75, the fall of Saigon. So the term the fall of the Roman Empire, the fall of Saigon, is a term that is often used to describe the demise of a whole empire or a whole political entity. What were the five empires, or the six, that had worldwide scope and extension? To which he might be referring. We've alluded to these before, we've even named these before, but for the sake of the discussion today, we'll name them again. The five or six worldwide empires that touched the known civilized world from the ancient times up until John was writing were the following. One, Egypt. Two, Assyria. That's northern Iraq. Three, Babylon. That's southern Iraq. Four, Persia. That would be Iran today. Five, Greece, actually Macedonia, because it's describing Alexander the Great, if you look at the Old Testament prophecy, and how his empire was divided among four generals following his death. Six, the one that now is Rome. These were the world empires up until the time that John wrote that had worldwide sweep and extension and scope. And they have fallen. The five certainly have fallen. One is, that would be Rome. That would be the contemporary one during which John is writing. And the other has not yet come. What might that other be? Well, there is no other candidate, once you look at what else is said later on here, for the one that has not yet come, than the empire of the Antichrist. And that empire of the Antichrist, unlike the earlier world empires, not only has wide scope, touching the whole civilized world, but actually does it. It actually does control the entire world. Whereas the other empires did not quite control the entire world. For example, none of the empires that I just described to you controlled China. And that had to be considered an empire unto itself, which, though it didn't have worldwide sweep, nevertheless was pretty extensive. So clearly, until this empire comes along, there's no empire that really controls the entire world. This one will. The one that has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue for a short time. When he comes, he must continue for a short time. Let's see if I can find the reference that I wanted to have you look at. Turn with me to the book of Daniel, chapter 7. The book of Daniel, chapter 7. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel. Daniel, chapter 7. Where we really have a description concerning the Antichrist who is to come, given now centuries before. Yes, sir. Egypt is first. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome is the sixth. And the seventh would be Antichrist. The eighth would be Antichrist Part B, after the resuscitation. Which is the same as the seventh, as it says in the text. Now, here in the book of Daniel, chapter 7, verses 19 to 25, we see prophecy concerning the future, the same future that is talked about by John the Apostle. There are fewer players, because don't forget that at the time that Daniel wrote, already it was the Babylonian Empire, wasn't even yet the Persian Empire, and so there was a fourth one to come, the fourth beast, whereas we describe it as the seventh beast because successive other empires came into being after Daniel wrote. So this is from his perspective, from Daniel's perspective, beginning in verse 19 of chapter 7 of Daniel. Then I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others. Exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze. This is often associated by those who analyze Daniel and other passages similar to this one as referring to Rome. But it is also, in a duplicate way, used to refer to the kingdom of the empire of the Antichrist, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet. Notice the reference to the ten horns, verse 20. And the ten horns that were on its head, same reference as we are seeing in Revelation, and the other horn which came up, before which three fell, and the three, of course, he's talking about are the prior world empires, and this fourth one that arises, from his perspective, is going to be the final one, though he doesn't know about the other empires yet to come. That horn which had eyes and a mouth, which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. Well, that description could fit a number of world leaders, including Nebuchadnezzar, for example. But in this particular instance, it perfectly fits the Antichrist, who does indeed, with great braggadocio, represent himself as the final world emperor, as indeed he will be, and saying blasphemous things about God. Verse 21, I was watching, and the same horn, that is the Antichrist, was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. And we know that during the time of the tribulation, the Antichrist will have his way, in a sense, at least politically, and in terms of his ability to put people to death. Verse 22, until the Ancient of Days came, which refers, of course, to God himself, God the Father, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High. And this refers, of course, to the victory that the Lamb and those who are coming back with him will have. And the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom, referring, of course, to the millennial kingdom that is to be. Verse 23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth. Notice the worldwide scope of this empire. Trample it and break it in pieces. The ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom. And another shall rise after them. That would be, of course, the second half of Antichrist's reign after the resuscitation. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings, that is, shall in fact take over all the prior world empires. Verse 25, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. This is the one thing that we see recurring over and over again, is the Antichrist, in following his master Satan, speaks with no respect whatsoever of God or of the things of God, and blasphemes right and left. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High. He shall persecute the saints of the Most High. We've already seen that in our study of the book of Revelation. He shall intend to change times and law. This, of course, occurs in the middle of the tribulation when all of the practices of Israel are overturned. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. This is the 3.5-year period. A time referring to a year, times 2 more years, and a half a time, a half a year. There's 3.5 years. So I wanted you to see this passage in Daniel because it anticipates, though from a different historical perspective and time, the same events that are being portrayed for us and prophesied for us here by John in the book of Revelation. So the short time refers to that 3.5-year, going back now to Revelation chapter 17. I didn't think we would quite make it through. Sure enough, we're not. But there's a lot of good stuff. You don't want me to race through all this good stuff, do you? Let's close at least with something here that we are reading, and that is verse 10. What we just finished covering, there are also seven kings or seven world empires. Five have fallen. That would be everything through the Macedonian Empire. One is, which is the Roman Empire. The other has not yet come, which is the Antichrist Kingdom, part A. And when he comes back, part B, he must continue a short time, which is for 3.5 years. Notice it gives you that clarity in verse 11. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth. This will be after the resuscitation. And is of the seven and is going to perdition. Notice that same goal, or shall we say outcome, for the Antichrist that is spoken of in the introduction. That brief pithy one in verse 8 is repeated here in verse 11. Same outcome, that is destruction, final destruction in hell, is the lot of the Antichrist. There's a lot of detail here. We should not get mired in the detail. The intent of the prophecy prophecies in the Old Testament and in the New Testament is not just to tickle our curiosity. It is not simply to help us sort of understand details that have been hidden and now somehow are brought to the surface so that we can enjoy the details and the intricacy of the prophecy. But rather, the purpose of it is to see that God is in control. That God is in control right down to the fine details of human history and even of our lives. And we say that God has a plan and a purpose for our lives, just as he has a plan and a purpose for the world. We're going to see more about that later on in the 17th chapter, that is his plan and his purpose for the world, as well as for our lives. I think we need to recognize the fact that we are not, if you will, loose cannons. We're not coals of fire out there burning by ourselves in a world, but that rather he has orchestrated and is orchestrating the whole course of human history as well as our own lives, causing all of these events to, if you will, conspire together in order to produce the results that he intends from all of eternity. When you recognize you have a God who is on the throne and a God who is in control and a God who has a purpose and a plan, and that the purpose and the plan goes down to the finest of detail, then you recognize that nothing is going to get out of control. And that's one of the things that the people of that church or of any time period who are under persecution sometimes feel, is God lost control. In our own lives, things seem to fall apart. Has God lost interest in me or lost control? The answer is no. We do not see the forest because we're in the middle of the trees. We don't see the big picture that God is giving for us here, the big picture, so that we can have confidence. That's the point about God's sovereignty. Not just the fact of his sovereignty, but the effect of his sovereignty upon us, which is to give us confidence that we serve a God who cares about us right down to the minute details of our lives and who will bring his plan to pass. I close with Philippians 1:6, one of the great verses of the Bible to memorize. Philippians 1:6. Being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will perform it all the way to the day of Jesus Christ. There'll be no lost plans. sins, no slip-ups. He'll perform it. He'll continue it and complete it all the way to the day of Jesus Christ. You will not be ever forgotten about. Your plan and purpose will be realized, hopefully with your cooperation. Sometimes we make it harder on him than we need to. But let's now go to the Lord in a time of prayer, shall we? Heavenly Father,